In the teeth of the Cold War, he headed for Annapolis. Bill Anders arrived at the United States Naval Academy in 1951 with the ambitious goal of becoming an officer aboard a destroyer and making four-stripe captain. By Christmas, he was about to wash out. He'd skated through high school on brains alone, but that level of effort wasn't cutting it at the academy, even as the son of a Navy Cross recipient. An advisor warned him he wasn't long for the place unless things changed. Anders straightened up. Having survived his first year at the academy, Anders returned to San Diego for the summer. There, he found himself on a double date at the beach. But when he saw his friend's date, he forgot about his own. 16-year-old Valerie Horde was about the prettiest young lady Anders had ever seen, and she had a quiet confidence beyond her age. Anders spent the day swimming alongside Valerie as she lounged on an inflatable raft, asking about her life, hearing her descriptions of how her father gave her rides on the back of his California Highway Patrol motorcycle, sirens blaring and red lights flashing. Anders never stopped to catch his breath as they toured all over Mission Bay. "This guy has a lot of endurance," Valerie thought. When Anders finally dropped her off at home, he shook her hand and said goodbye. Summer was drawing to a close, so Anders had to make the time count if he hoped to keep seeing Valerie. On their first official date, he took her to the Navy Officers Club and then to the Starlight Bowl to see the San Diego Civic Light Opera. The next night, he took her to the Old Globe Theater for Shakespeare. It was heady stuff for Valerie, and she was impressed with this serious young man. At home, she asked her mother why Bill shook her hand after dates, but didn't kiss her. The truth was that Anders didn't have much experience with girls and didn't want to push his luck. That was fine with Valerie. She had other suitors to keep her company. A few days later, Anders was back at the Naval Academy, and Valerie was back in high school. By his second year at Annapolis, Anders was rising up the class rank. He always found time to write letters to Valerie, long ones, every day, about his outlook on life, the challenges of the academy, how he saw the world. At Christmas, when he was home, they spent every day together. Not once since the day he met her had Bill doubted that Valerie was the one for him. She was poised and gracious, self-assured even in unfamiliar situations, and seemed curious about everything. She was a popular and busy senior who hardly had time for serious romance, yet she was slowly falling in love with Anders, and he was in love with her. The relationship did not please Muriel. She'd long thought her son should marry an admiral's daughter, a higher grade of folk, and took the formal tea dance invitations he'd received and lined them up on her kitchen window. Valerie saw the display when she was at Anders's house, but she also noticed something else, that he hadn't attended a single one of these debutante parties. He just wanted to be with her. In the summer before Anders's third year at the academy, he and about 400 classmates boarded the USS Bennington, an aircraft carrier bound from the East Coast for Halifax, to see how flyers operated at sea. Also aboard was an array of fighter aircraft, Panthers, Cougars, Crusaders, and the AJ Savage, a three-engine, nuclear weapon-carrying bomber. On the first night, a young Marine pilot made a landing approach in his Cougar, floated over all the wires, and slammed into a pack of parked airplanes. Such was the surplus of aircraft after the Korean War that sailors just pushed the damaged ones overboard rather than fix them. Hours later, an AJ Savage came roaring in and hit badly on landing. The pilot and co-pilot tumbled down the flight deck head over heels in their severed, flaming cockpit, but somehow managed to survive. The third crewman, however, died when he was thrown under the ship. The smoke had hardly cleared on that incident when Anders saw one of the gull wings of a Corsair fold up during takeoff. Just off the flight deck, the plane did a full roll and plummeted into the water. Immediately, the carrier headed toward the downed aircraft to make a rescue. Anders could see the pilot in the cockpit, but it was clear the man wasn't moving. Anders had been on the plebe swim team and could handle himself in rough waters. Now, he had a decision to make. He could jump in and try to rescue the pilot, or he could allow carrier rescue personnel to do what they were trained to do. The sight of the pilot, unresponsive and starting to sink, pulled on him. But he also knew the ship was moving at about 35 knots, he had no life jacket, and he'd have to fall about 50 feet before hitting the water. He had a thought that would bother him for years. If he did jump, he might get put on report or receive demerits. He saw a helicopter and a destroyer approaching to assist in the rescue, and in a split second, he made his decision to stay aboard the ship. Rescuers couldn't reach the scene, however, before the pilot and his airplane disappeared under the waves. Anders hardly knew what to make of the disasters he'd seen. Navy pilots were trained to be the best in the world in combat, yet they risked their lives every day, even during takeoff and landing. Still, an airplane had the power to take the fight to an enemy with an immediacy unavailable to giant ships. It was more personal, too, just pilot and machine as one. When it came time to decide what to do with his military career, Anders wanted nothing to do with aircraft carriers, but knew he had to fly. Anders continued to write to Valerie every day. Despite worries that she would turn him down, he bought an engagement ring and invited her to the Naval Academy's formal ring dance, at which couples would dance through a replica of the cadet's class ring. Valerie and Bill held each other close as they moved around the dance floor to the sounds of a big band. Valerie wore Bill's class ring on a chain around her neck and the engagement ring on her hand. Valerie still wasn't quite 18. Marriage meant giving up a college education, which was important to her. It also meant making a life with a man who'd chosen a dangerous line of work. But her father chased bad guys on his motorcycle for a living, and twice he had almost been killed on the job in accidents, so she was used to living with risk. There was also the matter of religion. Anders's father was a strict Catholic, and his church would insist that Valerie be Catholic too. In the end, that also seemed fine to a girl in love, and even though she was still in high school, Valerie said yes, knowing that Navy rules didn't allow midshipmen to be married until graduation, so a yes for the future. Not tomorrow, but a yes nonetheless. As a high-ranking member of his class, Anders had options with his career. He knew he wanted to fly, and he could decide between a commission in the Navy or the newly formed Air Force, established just 8 years earlier. Choosing the Navy meant operating from short carrier decks. Choosing the Air Force meant flying from 10,000-foot concrete runways. Anders chose the Air Force. Shortly after graduating from the Naval Academy in 1955, Anders married Valerie in a Catholic ceremony at the Naval Chapel in San Diego. He then reported to Air Force flight training near the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, where he began flying the T-34 Mentor. By the next stage in training, in the much bigger T-28, he realized that he had a natural ability. Sometimes he'd invite Valerie out to a dusty crossroads and put on a private air show for her, flying too low, testing to see how much vertical pull-up he could endure before blacking out from loss of oxygen to the brain caused by high G-forces, seeing if he could wake up before the plane went down. Valerie loved her husband's performances. She also liked that he didn't play things exactly by the book, that he took risks. To Valerie, the most interesting lives often seemed to go that way. After earning his wings at age 23, Anders was assigned to an Air Defense Command all-weather interceptor squadron at Hamilton Air Force Base near San Francisco, where he would fly the twin afterburner F-89 Scorpion. Interceptors flew to prevent enemy aircraft from penetrating restricted airspace, either by chasing them off or by engaging them in combat. Anders's jet was armed with two rocket-propelled missiles, each with a 3.5-kiloton nuclear warhead attached. Combined, it equaled about half the explosive power of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. To fire the weapons, the radar operator in the back seat had to throw a switch, and the pilot in the front seat had to throw his own switch. That's all it required. Officially, the crew needed an order from the ground, but if Anders and a buddy wanted to start World War III, they could do it on their own. That's the Cold War, Anders told Valerie. It's up to us not to screw up. In February 1957, the Anders family welcomed their first child, Alan. And in July 1958, Valerie gave birth to Glenn. Raising a young family in California was idyllic, with the warm weather and abundant culture. Maybe too good to be true. So it came as little surprise when Anders got a new assignment, Iceland. Valerie would stay with the kids in California while her husband moved 4,000 miles away. Again, Anders's job was to fly interceptors. This time, he would be going after Soviet bombers, long-range machines that flew missions near Iceland and the North Atlantic, designed to test American air defenses. To help avoid starting a world war, his aircraft and others would be armed only with conventional air-to-air rockets. No nukes. Early in his assignment, a Soviet bomber penetrated the eastern edge of Iceland's air defense identification zone. Anders and his wingman scrambled into the air, afterburners blazing, and caught up with the Russian plane. Anders positioned his wingman to shoot down the bomber if its pilot gave the Americans any trouble, then flew his F-89 so close he could call out the eye colors of the Soviet crew. The Russians smiled and waved. Anders offered his own American greeting, a middle finger. The Soviet crew kept smiling and waving, then broke back to where they belonged. Low on fuel, Anders returned to base, knowing the incident would be important to American intelligence officers, as it was among the first, if not the very first, intercept of a Soviet bomber in the zone. On the ground, he described the event. Anything else? Asked a representative of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Anders feared he would be facing some discipline. Still, he had to be honest. There is something else, Anders said nervously. I probably should tell you that, you know, I gave them the finger. The man smiled. There was no trouble. Anders flew more missions in Iceland, many of them risky, both for the dangerous flying conditions and for the potential conflict with Soviet bombers. 3 or 4 months after Anders flipped off the Russian crew, another pilot in his squadron intercepted a Soviet bomber. This time, the Russians had a response to their American pursuers, and they held it up to their window. A sign, printed in English, for the Air Force pilots to see. American intel had a good laugh when they heard the story. To them, it represented the layers of bureaucracy that constituted the Soviet socialist system. It had taken more than 100 days for the first bomber crew to report Anders's middle finger, for word to travel through channels to the Kremlin, for analysts to decipher it, for committees to formulate a response, for other committees to approve it, for translators to put the Soviet answer into English, for orders to be given to a new bomber crew, and for the Soviet pilots to deliver it. Their message to the Americans, flying alongside, "We fucked your sister." After more than a year in Iceland, Anders was sent back to Hamilton Field in California, a welcome return for Valerie. Anders continued flying interceptor missions, this time with the nuclear-armed supersonic F-101 Voodoo, a fearsome jet capable of reaching speeds in excess of 1,000 miles per hour. At Hamilton, Valerie became even more accustomed to the stresses of being married to a fighter pilot. Men died in this line of work. She knew that. But it was always terrible to see a black Air Force car drive into base housing to deliver the bad news. Every time she saw the black car, she wondered, is my life about to change? Could this happen to us? And even as the car passed her home and stopped at a neighbor's, she didn't kid herself. Yes, she thought, it could certainly happen to us. In December 1960, the Anders family welcomed a third child, Gail. Around the same time, Anders began to get itchy. Interceptor work was interesting, but he didn't feel pushed to his limits, not in body or mind, in a way that would make for a satisfying long-term career. In 1961, he went to see Chuck Yeager at the test pilot school at Edwards Air Force Base in Southern California. Pushing unproven airplanes to their limits demanded a new level of intellectual engagement, raw bravery, and adventure. To Anders, that sounded like the life he wanted. Yeager was impressed by Anders's flying credentials, but urged him to go back to college and obtain an advanced degree in science or engineering, since that's what the Air Force was looking for in test pilot candidates. Anders followed the recommendation and applied to the Air Force Institute of Technology at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base near Dayton, Ohio. He requested a program in either aeronautical or astronautical engineering, but administrators put him in nuclear engineering. To cover his bases, Anders enrolled in a night school program in aeronautics at nearby Ohio State University. Over the next 2 years, Anders studied, fathered another child, Gregory, and learned more about nuclear energy and radiation. In 1962, he graduated second in his class with a master's degree in nuclear engineering. He submitted his application for test pilot school, but now the school wasn't accepting new students. Dejected, he chose to go to the Air Force Special Weapons Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to work on a radiation shielding project and instruct pilots in jet aircraft. All the while, he waited for an opening at the test pilot school. Valerie took an astronomy course at the University of New Mexico, just out of fascination with the subject, a baby on her hip. In June 1963, Anders was driving in his Volkswagen microbus when he heard a news broadcast on the radio. The announcer said that NASA had decided to add a third group of astronauts. Anders met every one of the agency's requirements. Age limit, 35. 2,000 hours flying time in advanced jets. Maximum height, 6 feet. Must also be a test pilot, the man said. Anders's heart sank. Or the applicant must possess an advanced degree. Anders wondered if he'd heard the last part correctly. He pulled over to the side of the road and waited, through 12 minutes of commercials and bad music, for the next newscast. He had heard correctly. One needn't be a test pilot to apply. He wrote down NASA's address. He'd been interested in astronauts since the Mercury 7, the United States' first group of astronauts, had arrived on the scene 4 years earlier. But space travel had never seemed possible for mere fighter pilots. Now, things had changed. It would be his dream job in many ways. Joining NASA would give Anders the intellectual stimulation he craved, the chance to fly the most advanced machines ever built, and the opportunity to become an explorer, a space-age version of Charles Lindbergh or Vasco da Gama, the New World voyagers he'd always admired. And he could bring back unknown rocks from his journeys to the moon. And there was another benefit, one that resonated with a man whose father had fought back against America's attackers, even when the United States wasn't formally at war. He could do more in space than anywhere else to help defeat the Soviet Union. That night, Anders wrote a letter in longhand to NASA describing his qualifications. World's greatest pilot, can solve all space radiation problems. jet instructor, great guy. Valerie typed draft after draft after draft. They sent the final copy by certified mail the next day. It arrived with 4,000 other letters penned by astronaut hopefuls. To Anders's amazement, he was asked to report, along with about 100 others, to Brook Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas, for a physical. There, he was put through a battery of tests, not just physical, but psychological. Near the end of the process, only 28 finalists remained. Anders had to appear before the so-called Murder Board, a group of final interviewers that included current astronauts, Chris Kraft, and a doctor. He had little trouble with the questions from the space people. The doctor was another matter. "Well, Captain Anders," the man said, "your record looks pretty good, but we're worried about this concussion you had in the past." Anders had never suffered a concussion. Could the doctor be trying to trip him up? Test him? Or maybe the doctor had another applicant's records and believed he was interviewing a different candidate. Anders's mother had taught him never to lie, but she'd also reminded him that he needn't always blurt out the full truth either. On the spot, he formulated an answer. "Sir, I've never been bothered by a concussion." Bothered was the key word. That was true. On his 30th birthday, October 17th, 1963, the phone rang in the Anders home. Valerie handed him the receiver. It was Deke Slayton, calling with a job offer. Anders never did figure out if the doctors had been looking at the wrong guy's records, and as Slayton offered him a job, he was much too happy to care. NASA assigned each of its new astronauts to a specialty. Anders focused on radiation and environmental controls, cabin pressure, temperature, carbon dioxide, and so on. He also focused on potholes. After complaining about the condition of the roads near his new house, the town council named him street commissioner, a job he would hold, concurrent with his job as astronaut, for the next 2 years. Early in training, Anders gravitated toward two of his fellow new astronauts, Walt Cunningham and Rusty Schweikart. All three men had an intellectual bent, and all three were interested in space science. Not one had been a test pilot. Together, the trio tackled the single most vexing question at NASA. How does a new astronaut best position himself to get selected as soon as possible for a space flight? After careful analysis, they determined to increase their physical fitness, become more expert in their specialties, and further master the science of space travel. None of it made a ripple. To Anders, it seemed the more he and his pals tried, the more invisible they became to Slayton, the man who assigned astronauts to flights. And then it dawned on Anders. Slayton considered him, Cunningham, and Schweikart to be nerds. Slayton didn't seem to give a damn about Anders's advanced degree in nuclear engineering, or Cunningham's doctoral work in physics, or Schweikart's research on upper atmospheric physics at MIT. He certainly didn't seem to appreciate that Anders had signed up for extra geology field trips. Selection appeared to come down to two criteria: seniority and one's standing as a test pilot. And that wasn't good news for Anders or his friends. It all struck Anders as unfair, but he still had to look for an edge. It seemed to him that Slayton, an avid hunter, lacked astronauts who joined his hunts. Anders had little interest in shooting game, but when an invitation to an antelope hunt went out, he signed up. Slayton and at least a dozen astronauts packed rifles and flew to Lander, Wyoming. On arrival, each was given a single bullet. It was a one-shot hunt, and that's all the ammunition they were allowed. Anders wasn't going to shoot at an antelope unless he was certain he could hit it. And yet he knew he couldn't return to camp with an unfired bullet. Nothing would cement the view of him as a square more than that. After a time, he spotted an antelope walking peaceably a few hundred yards away. Anders had been on the Air Force pistol team and was a good shot. He hated to do it, but aimed his rifle and fired. His bullet tore into the antelope's hindquarters, sending the wounded animal running and bleeding. Anders followed the trail, then killed the antelope with his knife, all the while apologizing to the poor creature and thinking, "This is the last goddamn antelope hunt I'm going on." He knew astronauts were supposed to do manly things, but he also knew a hunt like this wasn't him. He determined never to go on another. Back in Houston, another astronaut, Alan Bean, joined Anders, Cunningham, and Schweikert in their unofficial group. Bean had been a test pilot, but as an avid painter, he seemed more artist than warrior. By now, Anders should have realized it didn't pay to look like an egghead, but since he and his friends weren't being put on crews anyway, they decided, with the exception of Bean, to enroll at Rice University to pursue PhDs. For all Anders knew, he was destined to sit on the sidelines forever. His fortunes, however, changed in early 1966 when he became Capcom for Gemini 8. Capcoms, or capsule communicators, were the astronauts at Mission Control who communicated by radio with the crew. A few minutes after Anders came on duty, pilot Dave Scott radioed to Control from space. "We have serious problems here. We're tumbling end over end up here." The spacecraft was rolling violently out of control while in orbit around Earth. Suddenly, NASA was face to face with disaster. While Anders calmly relayed information from Mission Control and reassured the astronauts, Commander Neil Armstrong battled to regain control of the ship by using the craft's re-entry thrusters. Several agonizing minutes later, Gemini 8 had been steadied. The mission was terminated early and the crew survived. Anders didn't think he'd done anything special, he'd just stayed cool under pressure. And it was Scott and Armstrong who deserved credit for a terrific save. But after Gemini 8, Anders registered brighter on Slayton's radar. Not long after, he was assigned, along with Armstrong, to be the backup crew for Gemini 11. He then joined Frank Borman's crew after the Apollo 1 fire in early 1967. Along with Mike Collins, he and Borman would man Apollo 9. Owing to problems caused by a bony growth between his neck vertebrae, Collins would later be replaced by Jim Lovell. The flight would be a high Earth orbit checkout of the full Apollo spacecraft. It wouldn't go to the moon, but it would put Anders in position to make that journey and to walk on the lunar surface on a subsequent Apollo flight. Anders spent long stretches away from home during training. Valerie was raising their 5 children. The family had welcomed another son, Eric, after Anders joined NASA, in El Lago, a small town near Houston where many astronauts lived, making Bill's paycheck go 7 ways. One day, Anders calculated the amount of time he spent with each of his kids, 11 minutes per week per child. He regretted it and didn't consider himself to be a good father because of all the time he spent away. But for now, beating the Russians was more important than being an ideal family man. Valerie saw it much the same way. She would have preferred her husband to be home more often, but she believed in NASA's mission and in winning the space race. Even if it wasn't easy running a household by herself, things never got boring for Valerie. She was interested in science and technology and in astronomy, so she watched with special interest as America worked its way to the moon, and she made sure her kids watched, too. One day, she took all 5 of them to Ellington Air Force Base to see Bill fly the Lunar Landing Research Vehicle, or LLRV, the closest thing engineers could build to approximate the lunar module astronauts would land on the moon. It was the weirdest ship any of them had ever seen, with a gimbal-mounted J-35 jet engine, 16 lift rockets, and seating for the pilot that looked like an outhouse without a door. Tubular arms and legs jutted in every direction. Together, the jet engine and lift rockets could simulate flying in 1/6 gravity, equal to that on the moon. Anders and Neil Armstrong took turns as pilot, making it look as if they were descending to the lunar surface. Aboard the ship, Anders felt like NASA's golden boy, one of the few who'd already been chosen to land on the moon. When the flying ended, 3-year-old Eric picked up a loose screw and swallowed it. NASA doctors took x-rays. A child never received a more state-of-the-art examination. It was a day unlike any Valerie had experienced. 24 hours later, on May 6, 1968, a system failure caused Armstrong to lose control while he was flying the LLRV. At an altitude of less than 200 feet, the machine pitched sideways and plummeted toward the ground. Armstrong ejected just moments before the craft impacted and burst into flames. Even with his parachute, his descent lasted only 10 seconds. When Anders told Valerie the story, she didn't get upset or ask her husband to reconsider his mission. She thought, as she often did, "This is the life we've signed up for." In August 1968, Anders told Valerie that he was going to the moon. Though the mission would be rushed, it seemed to her like an opportunity. She couldn't escape the feeling that America was in very bad shape. She'd seen the endless television coverage of race riots, Vietnam protests, and assassinations, and asked herself, where is our turning point? Where are we going to find hope? As a stay-at-home mom with no help, Valerie was busy from morning to night, taking care of her 5 children, mowing the lawn, trying to make ends meet on her husband's military salary. She had little time to figure out how to save America. But she knew that the chance for Apollo 8 to rise to a near-impossible challenge could be a positive statement in the country's crushingly negative year. Not long after Bill began training for Apollo 8, Valerie ran into George Lowe at a social event. They didn't speak of the new mission, but Valerie could see in Lowe's eyes that he had reservations about Apollo 8, that he'd contemplated what a huge step this was for NASA, that he knew how much could go wrong. She felt for him. What a difficult position he must be in, she thought, to be responsible for all this. As the launch date for Apollo 8 grew nearer, Anders had even less than the usual 11 minutes per week to give to each of his children. On one rare day off, he woke his family early and took them to water ski behind the tiny boat he owned, one with a 40-horsepower motor. In a few weeks, he would be riding an engine 4 million times more powerful than that. But for now, it was all the power he needed, enough to last for an entire day. Chapter 10. House 5050. Thanksgiving was just 3 days away, and less than 4 weeks remained until the scheduled launch of Apollo 8. While most Americans got ready to celebrate the holiday, Borman, Lovell, and Anders were hard at work with the sim soup. The focus during these pre-Thanksgiving sessions would be on 2 key aspects of the flight. The first, lunar orbit insertion, LOI, would come when the spacecraft arrived at the moon and fired its service propulsion system, SPS, engine, in order to slow down enough to be captured by lunar gravity and go into orbit around the moon. The second, trans-Earth injection, TEI, would come when the spacecraft fired that same engine to pick up enough speed to leave lunar orbit and head back to Earth. Both of these critical maneuvers would occur around the far side of the moon, completely out of touch with the engineers on Earth, who might catch any equipment malfunctions or slip-ups by the crew. More than almost anything else, it was TEI that worried the astronauts, controllers, engineers, and NASA officials. The SPS engine had no backup. If it misfired or didn't fire at all, the spacecraft and crew could crash into the moon, fly off into endless space, or be trapped in a slowly decaying lunar orbit that would ultimately impact the lunar surface. The simulations began early in the morning. More than once, the astronauts perished because someone didn't fix problems correctly or in time. In those cases, the crew and controllers held a short briefing afterward, discussed how they'd failed and what could be improved, then tried again. Over and over, scenarios were run, often for full days at a time. The more catastrophic, the better, until repetition began to groove instinct into all the participants. And dying helped the men learn to survive. Even at NASA, Thanksgiving was a day for family, and Borman, Lovell, and Anders found their way home just in time to celebrate the holiday. Apollo 8 was scheduled to launch in just 23 days, so Thursday was the only day off the men were allowed. By now, all three wives had decided where they'd be when Apollo 8 lifted off. Marilyn Lovell wanted to see it live, to be as close to it and as much a part of it as possible. She had been too far along in her pregnancy to watch Jim launch on Gemini 7, but she did witness his flight on Gemini 12 in person. And she wanted her four children to be there too. It was something she thought they should experience as a family. That was fine with Lovell. While he knew there was a chance of disaster, he never thought about launches or life in those terms, and he didn't want his children to think that way either. A person had to take things as they came. Lovell spread out his maps of the moon for his children and showed them which parts of the lunar surface he'd be flying over and what the crew intended to do there. He'd even brought his children to explore the simulator at the Cape. He didn't tell them that his mission was dangerous, or that their father might not be coming home. There was no reason to put a fear like that into children. Valerie Anders made a different decision. Her children were younger than Marilyn's, the flu was going around, and she didn't want to risk having five sick kids while holed up at a hotel near Cape Kennedy. The decision to stay home in Houston made a lot of sense to Anders. Even if his kids remained healthy, he wanted them and Valerie to be home, in a comfortable and safe environment, in case a disaster unfolded. In any event, Anders got the sense that his kids were more interested in water skiing and playing with their friends, which was fine with him. His 11-year-old son, Alan, told how a classmate brought his fireman father to school one day, and everyone thought that kid had the coolest father of them all. In this neighborhood, it seemed every old dad was an astronaut. When Valerie talked to the kids about Apollo 8, she explained what their father would be doing, but she never promised that he would be okay. She didn't want to mislead them. And they didn't seem worried anyway. They had other excitements to deal with, like the new color television Anders bought so his family could watch the launch, and the Life magazine photographers who were now showing up almost daily to take photos of the family doing things they didn't do in real life, like eating ice cream together at the kitchen table. When Borman arrived home for Thanksgiving, Susan had the house perfect and ready for him, as she always did. In the 1950s, when they were moving from base to base, she'd read and absorbed The Army Wife by Nancy Shea, a book about making a good life and a good home while married to a military man. Every Army wife has three basic responsibilities, the author wrote. 1. To make a congenial home. 2. To rear a family of which he will be proud. 3. To strengthen her husband's morale. Your whole scheme of life revolves around your husband, your children, and a happy home, Shea added. Susan had been the perfect Army wife for 18 years, since Frank had graduated from West Point in 1950. But now, she wondered whether she'd be able to keep it up, whether the pressure might finally break her. Susan believed, with 100% certainty, that Frank was going to die aboard Apollo 8. Frank knew she had been drinking, but he didn't think she had a problem because She kept such a beautiful home, raised her sons with honor and dignity, and never expressed a moment's concern for herself. He'd never seen her drunk, not once. When he discussed Apollo 8 with Susan, she told him, "I know you'll be fine." Inside, she was dying, watching her life and the lives of her sons being torn apart before her eyes, her best friend being taken away forever, to a place she could never reach. If Borman had had even an inkling that his wife was suffering, he would have explained the mission to her, laid out maps, described how thoroughly NASA had engineered the flight, listed all the precautions that were in place. If her sons, now 17 and 15, had known that their mother was so worried, they would have hugged and reassured her. But no one knew, which was just how Susan wanted it. She didn't want anyone to suffer on her account. As launch neared, Susan hosted a cocktail party with many NASA folks in attendance. During a quiet moment, she pulled Chris Kraft aside. "Chris, I'd really appreciate it if you'd level with me," Susan said. "I really, really want to know what you think their chances are."
"You really mean that, don't you?" Kraft asked.
"Yes, and you know I do. I really want to know."
Kraft respected Susan. He thought she deserved an honest answer, and he did not want to sugarcoat things for her. Often during meetings about Apollo 8, George Miller had pushed a piece of paper in front of Kraft and other senior NASA managers and asked them to estimate the probability of success at each phase of the flight. Doing that would then yield the chances of success for the total mission. Kraft had been amazed to find his estimate to be within 1% of George Lowe's, and it's the one he gave Susan as she looked him in the eye with her question.
"How's 50-50? He said.
To Kraft, that seemed a hopeful number, given that the crew would be accomplishing so many new things at once. The first to fly the Saturn V, the first to journey to the moon, and the first to confront the other myriad new challenges involved. In fact, Kraft had misunderstood Susan's question. He thought she was asking about the odds of a successful mission in which its objectives were met and the spacecraft and systems performed as designed. He and Lowe had figured those odds to be about 56%. If he'd understood that Susan was asking about the crew's chances of surviving the mission, he would have placed the odds higher. And yet Susan, who believed her husband had no chance of coming home alive, was happy with a 50-50 shot that Frank would live.
"Good," she told Kraft. "That suits me fine."
That night, when Susan talked to Frank, she told him the cocktail party had been lovely. In the first days of December, a new issue of Time magazine hit the newsstands. The cover image, set against a brilliant blue sky, showed two space travelers, one American, the other Soviet, sprinting toward the cratered lunar surface. Four words appeared on the cover: "Race for the Moon." The story inside summarized NASA's plans to send Apollo 8 to the moon and the Soviets' push to send Zond 7 before the Americans could launch. Even at this late date, with just days remaining until the Soviet launch window opened on December 8th, the race was too close to call. In Moscow, the Soviets appeared to be celebrating early. Already, they had named a 70-mile-wide crater on the far side of the moon, photographed by Zond 6, in honor of two Soviet scientist brothers. In Florida, Anders was doing some naming of his own. Working from photos taken by unmanned spacecraft, he began assigning names to several of the most interesting and prominent craters never before seen by human eyes, ones he expected to see during his flight. Whether the International Astronomical Union would accept those designations once the crew had actually seen the craters remained to be determined. It was around this time that Miller asked the Apollo 8 astronauts to sign a statement confirming that they'd been properly trained by NASA
To Anders, that came as a bitter disappointment. Miller was the boss. He should have been the one to tell the crew they'd been properly trained. Instead, he seemed to want a waiver in case anything went wrong. By early December, the eyes of the world were trained on Kazakhstan. Cosmonauts were already at the launch pad there, awaiting the mission's final go-ahead. On December 8th, many at NASA held their breath. If the Soviets were going to send a manned spacecraft to the moon, this was the 48-hour window during which they would do it. More than a decade in the making, the space race was coming down to a matter of hours. The first day passed. The Soviets now had 24 hours to make their move to the moon. The second day passed. The Soviets now had just a few hours remaining. If they were going to beat the United States, they had to do it now. By midnight, it was clear that nothing had happened at Baikonur. Technically, it was still possible for the Soviets to go, even as late as December 10th. But by many assessments, if they were going to go in December, they would have gone already. For the first time since the space race began, nothing stood between America and the moon. Nearly 200 members of the media were accredited for an early December press conference in Houston with Borman, Lovell, and Anders. They were shown film of the astronauts' training and were then allowed to ask questions of the three astronauts. A reporter asked about recent comments by Sir Bernard Lovell in which the famed British astronomer had criticized NASA for taking undue risk by flying Apollo 8. I have the highest regard for him and I hope he has his telescope, his radio dishes beamed on us, Borman said. He's done a great job of tracking in the past. When asked about the risks of the flight, Borman answered straight, as always. I think there are sensible risks. If we really believe what we're doing is worthwhile, then we accept the risk. When we get to the point where we don't believe it's worthwhile, I'll quit. In fact, Borman had already quit. Several days earlier, he'd told NASA that he wouldn't fly in space after Apollo 8. Since becoming an astronaut in 1962, his mission had been simple, to beat the Soviets to the moon. If all went well, Apollo 8 would do that. To risk another lunar journey just to pick up rocks or add a fraction to mankind's knowledge about the moon didn't seem worth it after the battle had been won. As he answered questions and made the media laugh, few could have predicted this sudden turn in Borman's career. He was the consummate astronaut, a man for whom the mission always came first. Those who knew him best, however, might have guessed that there was an additional reason for his decision to hang it up after Apollo 8. By now, consciously or otherwise, Borman had come to see the stress his career placed on Susan, and he couldn't have any more of that. After the press conference, the astronauts prepared to fly from Houston to Florida, where they would live for the remaining 2 weeks before their launch. This would be their last chance to say goodbye in person to their wives and children. Borman and Lovell said farewell to their families at home, wished them a Merry Christmas in advance, and told them they'd celebrate the holiday after they returned to Earth. Anders did the same, but then he gave Valerie a small package. It contained an audio tape. He asked that she play it in the event he didn't make it back. Anders was a private person and didn't tell anyone what he'd said on the tape. It began, "You children and your mother are the most important." Much of the rest of it came down to this: expressions of love for Valerie and the kids, a reminder that he missed them already, a hope that Valerie would marry again in the future, and an assurance that he'd died doing what he wanted to be doing. At the Cape, the men checked into their new quarters, each getting a tiny room with little more than a steel bed and a steel desk, but with a large adjoining living room to share. Framed copies of classic paintings competed with lunar maps for space on the walls. It was a comfortable, if cramped, existence, and one deemed necessary by NASA, to prevent the crew from catching bugs or viruses from the outside world that might short-circuit their ability to fly. The sole luxury came in the form of a personal chef. No sooner had the astronauts arrived at the Cape than they had to pack their bags again. Lyndon Johnson had invited them and their wives to the White House for a formal dinner and send-off, just 12 days before the flight. System checklists and countdown procedures swimming in their heads, the astronauts boarded a charter flight to Washington. Doctors didn't like the idea. The Hong Kong flu pandemic, which would kill more than 33,000 in the United States alone in a six-month span, was reaching its peak, and the astronauts were supposed to be in quarantine. When a NASA doctor tried to object, LBJ issued a Texas-sized, "Who the hell does he think he is?" For the crew of Apollo 8, there was a silver lining, a last, unexpected chance to kiss their wives goodbye. As the astronauts flew to the White House, the family of one of the 30,000 Americans killed so far during the fighting in Vietnam prepared for their own visit to the nation's capital. On October 31st, 1967, just a month before he was to return home, Captain Riley L. Pitts of the U.S. Army led his company on an assault of a Viet Cong position in the dense jungle of Ap Dong, South Vietnam. After enduring withering fire, Pitts threw his body on top of an enemy hand grenade and waited to die. When the grenade failed to explode, Pitts moved his company forward, putting himself in the direct line of enemy fire until he was cut down in a hailstorm of bullets. As the crew of Apollo 8 arrived with their wives at the White House, Captain Pitts's widow, Eula, laid out a dark suit and a bow tie for her 5-year-old son, Mark, and a fine white blouse for her 7-year-old daughter, Stacy, at their home in Oklahoma City. The next day, the president would make her husband the first African-American officer ever to receive the nation's highest military decoration, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Millions of Americans considered astronauts to be the epitome of American courage. To Borman, Lovell, and Anders, that label better belonged to men like Pitts. Joining the crew of Apollo 8 and their wives at the Black Tie Gala were 20 other astronauts, Chris Kraft and Wernher von Braun, and former NASA chief James Webb, who was to be awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom later in the evening. Also present was Charles Lindbergh, who'd stunned the world when he flew nonstop from New York to Paris in 1927. To many at NASA, despite his controversial political views, Lindbergh was a pinnacle aviation hero, a man who had taken to the skies to do the impossible. Before dinner, a small concert was staged in the East Room. When Valerie Anders took her place in the audience, she was dismayed to hear dozens of people coughing and sneezing. "This is so stupid," she thought. "They are putting this crew at risk." And yet there was no escape for any of them. So they stayed. Droplets of the Hong Kong flu and who knows what else atomizing into the room. During dinner, Kraft got to talking to Lindbergh about airplanes, a nuts and bolts conversation between one of the great original aviators and an old flight test engineer. Seated nearby with the president, Borman stole glances toward Kraft's table, envying the conversation he was missing. He also noticed that LBJ seemed irascible, describing his annoyance at a press corps, and maybe an entire swath of the American public, whose criticism of his Vietnam policies seemed to have beaten him down. Listening to the president rail against the media, Borman felt empathy for Johnson, not just for the stigma of Vietnam that would attach to his legacy, but for how it must feel to be a man in the final days of his standing, knowing that soon he would never again matter in the way he once had. Chapter 11. "My God, we are really doing this,"
The crew of Apollo 8 returned to their quarters at Cape Kennedy on December 10th. Just 11 days remained until their mission. Their schedule would be simple from this point forward. Train in the simulator, study the flight plan, jog. At night, when he could find a spare moment, Borman walked outside his tiny bedroom and looked up at the moon. On December 15th, at 7 p.m. EST, NASA began its official launch countdown, 5.5 days before the planned liftoff. That gave everyone associated with the flight time to coordinate and to fix any problems that might arise along the way. As the clock started ticking that Sunday evening, Lovell borrowed a car and drove 60 miles north along the Florida coast to a town called Edgewater, where he rang the doorbell at a house near the beach. His mother, Blanche, opened the door. She lived here now. Her 73rd birthday was approaching, and her son had come to celebrate early. Over dinner, Jim explained the mission to his mother. Sitting shoulder to shoulder on the living room couch, Jim sketching out his rocket's trajectory, Blanche wearing her glasses and leaning in for a closer look, the two might have been in Milwaukee 30 years earlier. A mother and her young son, who had only each other to rely on, each present for the other one's dreams. The next day, NASA Chief Tom Paine flew to the Cape to visit with the astronauts and to deliver an important message. After dinner, and a few drinks to loosen things up, Paine spoke frankly to Borman, Lovell, and Anders, with one final statement he wanted them to remember. He laid it out like this. First, if any of them had any reservations going into the flight, anything they hadn't felt comfortable discussing with Chris Kraft or Deke Slayton or anyone else at NASA, even if it was nothing more than a feeling or an intuition that something wasn't right, he should feel free to bring those concerns to Paine. And he would personally see to it that the issue was addressed and fixed, no matter what, and without consequence to them. Second, if the crew had any doubts or worries during the mission, with how the flight was progressing, with the function of the spacecraft or systems, with anything, he should feel free to abort the mission and bring the ship back early, and Paine would guarantee a seat on a subsequent flight as soon as possible. No one, he told the astronauts, would lose his chance to go to the moon for ending a flight in the name of safety. Borman, Lovell, and Anders thanked Paine for the offer, but none of them expressed any concerns about Apollo 8. All of them expected it would require a hell of a lot more than a feeling or an intuition to U-turn a spacecraft bound for the moon. On December 17th, 4 days before scheduled liftoff, Marilyn Lovell and her 4 children landed in Florida and checked into a beachside cottage. Valerie Anders, too, had managed to make the trip, catching a ride with a NASA contractor. Valerie had come only for the day, to squeeze in a final goodbye with her husband before returning home to be with their children. The next day, Jerry Lederer, director of NASA's Office of Manned Spaceflight Safety, spoke to a group of aviation enthusiasts in New York. Apollo 8, he said, had one safety advantage over the voyage undertaken by Christopher Columbus in 1492. Columbus did not know where he was going, how far it was, nor where he had been after his return. With Apollo, there is no such lack of information. There was, however, the matter of complexity. Apollo 8 has 5,600,000 parts and 1,500,000 systems, subsystems, and assemblies, Lederer noted. Even if all functioned with 99.9% reliability, we could expect 5,600 defects. For that reason, Lederer concluded, Apollo 8's mission would involve risks of great magnitude and probably risks that have not been foreseen. As darkness fell in Florida that night, Lovell took Marilyn out on a date. They didn't go to a restaurant or a movie, but rather to a place virtually no one on Earth could access, to see one of the newest wonders of the world.
And no matter how high Marilyn looked when they reached the Cape, she still could not see where the great Saturn V ended. It just kept stretching